again to everybody out there in the full turd world. This is your pal, Turd Ferguson, opening up another award-winning presentation that we call A2A. We do these every week, where we bring on some of the biggest movers and shakers in the precious metals industry and let you have at them, let you ask them whatever is on your mind. Today should be a rollicking good time as we have a guy who I consider a friend, a strong advocate for everything that we do here in precious metals and in trying to defeat these evil, rascally, fraudulent bankers. And it is Dave Kranzler, also known as Denver Dave Kranzler, who's obviously based somewhere in Utah. Sorry, Jesus. Anyway, Dave, Denver Dave, I've known for a while. He is a money manager. He co-manages a precious metals fund out of Denver. He is an author and analyst. He runs a great site, Investment Research Dynamics. He also has a subscription component to the site, a couple of legs of it called the Mining Stock Journal and the Short Sellers Journal, and we'll talk about that today too. But to begin with, Dave, welcome back to TFMR, man. It's always good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me, Craig. It's great to be back. I love doing this show.
It's a fun time to be alive, my friend. There's a lot going on. Like I said, you do a great job of chronicling every day what happens. But tell everybody again, give them an update on your site and what you're doing with those two journals, we'll call them.
Sure. I mean, my blog is Investment Research Dynamics, and that's been around. I think I launched it. Well, I launched the predecessor, The Golden Truth, in like 2009, and I did it just in lieu of spending money on couch time with a psychiatrist because the markets were driving me crazy and the political environment was driving me crazy. And about 3 or 4 years ago, I morphed it into Investment Research Dynamics and kind of upped the quality of it and upped the professionalism of it. And in early January, I launched the Short Sellers Journal because I thought it's a subscription service that's monthly, but I publish it weekly, and I give market commentary and come up with what I think are going to be good short sell ideas. And they're really meant to be long-term ideas, although if I see something that I think might get hit in the next week or two because of earnings or some other event, I throw that in there as well. And then shortly after that, because of the response to that, and really my ultimate forte, at least in my own opinion, is the junior mining stocks. And I've been trading and researching and investing and analyzing those since late 2001. So I launched the Mining Stock Journal, and that's bi-monthly. And what I do is I have some research on there that are big, long, in-depth research reports. And what I decided to do was most readers just want the Cliff's Notes on an idea, on a stock idea. So what I do is I present typically a junior mining stock idea, and I try to look for ideas that are not as well known out there, not as well covered, but ideas that I think are going to be home runs. And we own, at least so far, we own all the ideas in the fund that I co-manage. And a couple of the ideas I discovered as I was doing the journal, and I put them right into the fund. I think they're great ideas. So, and then I also, again, in my own opinion, I provide what I think is some unique insight on what's going on in the precious metals market. So
Dave, at a time when we're thinking the general stock market is due to go down, but the mining shares are looking like to continue higher, seems to be you're right in the right spot. How does somebody find out about both or either of those services? They go to Investment Research Dynamics and get a link from there?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And can you tell us how much it is to sign up?
Oh, yeah, sure. Both services are $20 a month each, and they're recurring, but, after the first month, if you don't like it, you send me an email and I can cancel it, or, you can cancel it yourself on your end. If the listeners want a sample report of either, I'd be happy to email it to them. Just contact me. They can contact me at investmentresearchdynamics@gmail.com or dkranzler62@gmail.com. I'm on both of those all the time.
Fabulous. And I would, again.
Oh, one more thing. If they subscribe to both, you know, separately they're $20 a month. If they subscribe to both, the combined it's $30 a month. So we've got a lot of subscribers who actually do that.
So let me see if I got this straight then. So somebody could subscribe to you for $30 a month and get both of these reports, or they could spend the same amount or more and get a subscription to Trader Dan?
Don't get me started on him.
I just thought I'd make sure we knew what kind of value we were talking here. All right. Now, again, for everybody listening, here's how this works. I've got a couple questions for Dave. But when you logged in to go to webinar, a control panel should have popped up on your computer screen. And within that control panel is a tab for questions. So if you have something you'd like to ask Dave directly, you type it in. It shows up on my screen. And then I relay it to Dave, and he answers your question for you. But before we get started, I have a couple of things I want to discuss. So, Dave, let's just dive right in. We were getting caught up before we got started, and you asked me if I thought that this was different, if anything was really changed in 2016. In fact, I just was doing an interview an hour ago where the same topic came up. And I mentioned just the fact that we've made higher highs. And if you draw down channel on the gold price from 2013, we've broken out of that channel clearly as well. But obviously, as a miner, you're watching the miners too, that seems to be a confirmation as well. We moved up 125% or 130% in 100 days. Okay, a little 10% correction these last couple of days, but how do you feel as a mining share analyst going forward? Do you have strong convictions that we're just getting started?
You know, again, everyone who's been doing this sector for as long as we've been doing it, you're kind of hesitant, and I've sensed this sort of reluctance even amongst longtime precious metals bulls because of what we've been through for the last 4 or 5 years. I mean, it was getting to the point where it felt like the bullion banks and the central banks had a complete grip on the market. But where I really started to get some hope was that day when they took silver down on the LBMA. I think it was 80 cents from where it was trading to when they fixed the price.
Yep.
And I looked at that, and to me, that just smelled of complete desperation. And that was when I actually wrote a blog post about it. I said, I think this is the bottom of the market. And, well, unfortunately, that particular day was about a month after I had said that I think silver is going to be the best investment for the balance of the decade. But I still think that, and look at how we've bounced back. I mean, when they did that maneuver, the futures markets literally bounced right back almost 40 or 50 cents right after they fixed the price. So that told you how artificial it was. And I think it reflected the bullion bank's last gasp effort to try and clear out as much physical silver as they could at as cheap a price as possible in London, because I think they do face a physical shortage over there. It may not be overtly apparent because of the way they publish the numbers, but I think there's issues going on. So, again, and where I'm also encouraged is that every time they try to take down the sector, it seems to bounce back really quickly. And what if I want to say, since probably mid-December, and it may be a little bit after that, but silver's been slowly outperforming gold, and to me, that's really one of the hallmark indicators that, you know, the bull market is resuming. So, and one more thing, again, the sentiment out there, even amongst, you know, hardcore precious metals bulls, there's still sort of like this wall of worry that everyone's climbing. And to me, that's healthy. That tells me that we have a lot further to go before we get any really meaningful kind of price correction, whether it's a natural price correction or a manipulated price correction.
Yeah. Well, and you know what? I was just writing about this morning. I mean, we were up Monday to Friday last week, that week of the last week of April. The cumulative 5 days were up every single day in gold for $60. I mean, that's almost a 5% move in a week. And now here we are 4 days into the next week. And as I speak, we're at 1280. We're down $10. I mean, isn't that just incredible that there've been no traction to the downside?
It's very encouraging, especially when you look at the traditional indicators, like, you know, where gold is positioned relative to the 50-day moving average and the 200-day moving average, and the commitment of traders report, the way the COTS set up you know, in terms of the short position of the bullion banks versus the long position of the hedge funds. And, I mean, I'm as guilty as anyone on this. I was looking at that, and I'm like, oh, boy, we're going to get taken down.
Yeah.
And I thought we were going to get taken down in late February when we had options expiration, and then I think it was the employment report and options expiration were in the same week or something. I forget exactly what it was. There was some big Fed report that usually comes out, and they usually annihilate the metals, and it didn't happen. And we just kept, you know, they tried to hit it, and it kept going higher and higher, and all throughout March, the same thing.
Yeah.
And so I really think the character of the market's a lot different right now.
Well, and so I want to ask you, I guess, in the last question I have for you before we get to the questions that are already starting to pile up, I want to kind of look forward a little bit. You know, a lot of that movement last week, that $60, was due to just a collapsing dollar index. And it got all the way down to 91, 97 or something like that in the wee hours a couple days ago before magically reversing and turning higher. Nonetheless, though, the chart for the dollar looks terrible. You know, there's this guy, Jim Rickards, who I don't know his motives or his motivation, and I frankly don't really trust him. But nonetheless, he's been reporting for several weeks now on what he calls the Shanghai Accord. That was a meeting of the G20 and the finance leaders and everything that occurred in Shanghai on February 26th, and how it was an accord, you know, established, signed on to weaken the dollar, remove the dollar eventually as a reserve currency, and start implementing a basket of currencies instead. Man, I tell you what, Dave, you look at that chart of the dollar since February 26th, it's been nothing but straight down. So it makes you wonder, I mean, what do you think about the dollar, especially with all this talk about rate hikes and everything else? And then furthermore, God, it's like I'm the guest. I'm asking, here's this long, lengthy question, but I'll get to you eventually, all right? So just hang on. I'm kidding.
No worries.
Furthermore, if the dollar weakness is also helping to drive gold, and if the large lion's share of the dollar index is the euro, and now we've got this vote coming up in about 6 weeks on, you know, the Brits leaving the eurozone. They call it Brexit. Putting that all together over the next 6 weeks, what are you expecting?
That's a really good question, Craig. And it's impossible to really forecast a short-term direction for this market because there's so much manipulation and intervention.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the problem that the central banks have right now in controlling especially the precious metals. But I think at some point they're going to lose their grip on the stock market as well. And so I think that they've kind of got themselves in a, on Wall Street, we used to call it a Polish hedge, for lack of a better term, and with all due respect, and not to be politically incorrect, but that's what we called it. And I think what it means is they think that they have everything hedged out and figured out and under control, and it could actually backfire on them and work the opposite of what they think is going to happen. And you know, at the end of the day, I think ultimately even the central banks don't really know how bad things are behind the scenes because they're going off of what their bank members are telling them or in their books in terms of derivatives. And I know for a fact that banks lie. And I know for a fact that the people who are running these banks don't know the truth because the troops lie.
Right.
I mean, we used to lie to our back office all the time about what we had, and we used to use derivatives to hide them. And that's why you get those incidences like the London Whale. So in terms of what's going to happen over the next 6 weeks and how the market might respond to a Brexit or, you know, whether we'll even get a vote that affirms a Brexit, you know, who knows? I think it's just impossible to kind of forecast. What I do know is that between now and a year from now, I think that the dollar is going to be a lot lower. I think the precious metals are going to be a lot higher, and I think the S&P is going to be a lot lower. I just don't know what path it's going to take.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and Dave, to your point, you recall March the 10th, you know, when the ECB announced that they were going to expand QE by buying corporate debt and all that kind of stuff, and the euro went down for about 45 minutes and then went straight up. And in the time since, has only gotten stronger. And so, yeah, you can't necessarily look at that and go, well, British, you know, if they vote to leave the Eurozone, and that's going to make the euro go down. Well, not necessarily. So you're right. We're just going to have to pay close attention.
Well, you know, in terms of the dollar, there's a couple components going on there. First of all, I think part of what, besides outright intervention in the market by the Fed, I think what ran the dollar up is this expectation, even though we knew that there's no way they were going to raise interest rates, for some reason the market, every Fed meeting that came around, you know, a few weeks leading up to it, the dollar would rally. Oh, no, they're going to, this is going to be the time. And it's like these guys, you know, the boy who cried wolf, I think after the third time, no one believed him. Well, the Fed cries wolf now, has been crying wolf now for 3 or 4 years. And every time they believe like this will be the time that they're going to raise rates. And so I think there's been this natural expectation in the market that, you know, the dollar should be trading stronger than these other currencies because the U.S. has a more rational interest rate policy potentially. And I think the market's starting to lose that expectation. And I think there's some majorly, as you've pointed out with the dollar yen, and you've done a great job with that. Like, you know, one of the leading guys out there talking about the dollar yen, I think there's a dollar yen carry trade going on that is just massive and needs to be unwound.
Yeah.
And as that unwinds, it's going to be volatile, but the dollar's going to just go a lot lower. I mean, the dollar index almost lost 71 in 2008, and I think, you know, if this is the time when we lose 71 this time around, I mean, people are going to be shocked at how high the precious metals go.
Yeah, we sure have a lot of fun going from here to 71, I can tell you that. But, you know, but it is interesting, and it'll be fun to watch. And like you said about interest rates, it's just astonishing that nobody – well, I think we know why it's never discussed on CNBC or Bloomberg. But with Japan at negative rates and the Eurozone all at negative rates, it's like there's this like stunning – what I'm so stunned that U.S. rates keep going down on the long end because there's buyers for U.S. debt when everything else is negative. It's a, if the Fed raises short rates, all they're going to do is invert the yield curve. And it seems like nobody – I mean, like I'm assuming that some bubblehead on Bloomberg, it actually is, took economics in college. But still, I mean, would you expect somebody to make that connection?
No, of course not. It's all propaganda. You know, one thing that I wanted to mention here, you know, when you read Zero Hedge, you think that the whole world has negative rates except the United States. But if – and I looked at this a few months ago, and I'm just – talking off the top of my head now, but if you look at like I think China's short-term interest rates are like 5%, and same with Russia. Russia's might even be higher.
Yeah.
So it's not like the whole world has a ZERP policy, and the Fed is, you know, almost at a ZERP policy. So, you know, on a relative basis, the dollar should be a lot weaker than it really is, and I think the artificiality that's held it up is at some point the floor or the rug's going to be pulled out from under it, and it's probably going to be shocking at how quickly the dollar drops.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Dave, I'm going to turn to subscriber and listener questions before we get to the ones that are already in queue. And again, if you've got a question for Dave, click the questions tab on your GoToWebinar control panel and type it in. But first, I had a guy from a regular who couldn't join us today, but this question from this guy I thought was right in your wheelhouse, so I'm going to start with that one. This comes from a guy by the name of Gaz. And Gaz wants to know, he said, I heard a number of commentators in the metal space suggest that fiat usually flows into the miners in a certain order. Majors first, then mid-tier, and then finally juniors, and then exploration after that. Is this accurate in your experience? And then he wants to know specifically if you have any insights regarding something called Bear Creek mining. So there you go. There's a two-part question for you.
Sure. No, those are good questions. Real quickly, because I just looked it up. China's overnight lending rate is 435. Yeah, 435. Russia's is 11%. So that's just, and if you go through these list of countries, there's a whole host of them that have, you know, much higher overnight lending rates than the Western countries do. You know, the Eurozone, the U.S., and Japan. But back to that question. I think historically, you know, when we went through the first leg of the bull market and you'd have correction, price corrections, I think that it was typical that the large cap mining companies would lead the pack. And then, as he pointed out, money would flow to the mid tiers and then to the juniors. I think this time around, again, I think because of the extreme intervention and the degree to which the junior minors got beaten down to a bloody pulp, you know, I don't know that history is going to repeat in terms of the way the capitals flow. And I know that since there's not really a true good index of junior mining stocks, I mean, GDXJ, if you look at the market caps of the stocks that make up that index, I mean, most of them are not even what I would consider necessarily junior mining stocks. So if you want to look at the junior mining stocks that have a market cap of, say, under 100 million or under 50 million, and that's really where I like to focus because I think that's where most of the upside is. A lot of those stocks have just been knocking the cover off the ball, even versus the large caps. Now, there has been some stocks like First Majestic, and that thing's gone up, I think, about 400 or 500% since, I don't know, probably mid-December or mid-January. But some of these juniors, like I handed one out to, I didn't have the mining stock journal yet, but I had the short sellers journal, and I would put up this junior mining stock that I had just learned about. I knew it was coming, and I knew it was there. I just hadn't focused on it, and it was First Majestic took over Silvercrest Mines, which was a silver mine down in Mexico, and they spun off some of the related properties, and the key existing management took over the spin-off company. And when I presented that company, like on January 10th, was at 11 cents. And now it's at 92 cents. So that's like an example of a junior that's not a well-known junior out there that, I mean, has just knocked the cover off the ball. And you'd rather be in that than, say, in Gold Corp or First Majestic, which I think is a fantastic company.
Yeah.
So in terms of, you know, what the capital flows are going to be this time around, I actually think sorry about the dog here.
He's happy to see it.
I actually think that – I think the market's smarter this time around, and I also think that the juniors became so historically cheap in that last smackdown that we had that I think the juniors are going to, especially the juniors that deserve to exist as companies. And let's, you know, make no mistake about it, there's a lot more junior names out there that are really not, you know, they shouldn't even exist or be allowed to raise capital. But they will, because that's the kind of market that we're heading into, and everyone wants to find the next Franco Nevada or the next, you know, the next home run play. So, but the juniors that, a lot of these junior companies started trading at levels that were below their cash balance on the sheet.
Right.
And most of them have, like, you know, a lot of them were able to like, not spend money during that downturn, and they conserved their cash. And now you have, you know, a lot of these companies are sitting on verifiable deposits, and those are the ones that you really want to dig out and look for. Now, in terms of Bear Creek Mining, I actually have that on my list to look at. I looked at it quite some time ago, and at the time when I looked at it, and this would have probably been before the big smackdown in 2011, and I thought that it had gotten a little bit overvalued relative to its potential, but I'm sure it's been annihilated like everything else, and I just can't speak intelligently about it right now in terms of what it is. I know it's the real deal. I just don't know what the price looks like in terms of what their fundamentals are.
Fair enough. All right.
But I will put it on my list and take a look at it.
All righty. Well, let's dive right in. I've got some questions in queue. And then remember, these are going to bounce around a little bit. This is a good one for you to put your old former Wall Street hat on as you answer this one. It comes from a guy by the name of Mike. He just wants to know. He says, you know, this default on bonds out of Puerto Rico seems to be a pretty big deal. We'll just leave it at that. What do you think of what's going on there, Dave?
I don't really know exactly what to make of that. I thought it was going to be when the whole thing first started developing, and I wrote a couple blog posts about it back when it first was becoming an issue. I thought it was going to be a bigger problem than it seems to be right now. I do think it's the tip of the iceberg on what's coming. I think it's been out there for so long. My guess is that the Federal Reserve has figured out together with the working group on financial markets, that, you know, the interventionary market interventionary arm of the Treasury, I think they've probably figured out a way to cushion the blow on that. And that's just a semi-educated guess.
Yeah.
Because they defaulted on some of their bonds on Monday, and the market didn't really seem to care. So I think really what's going on with Puerto Rico is indicative of what we're going to start seeing eventually with the bigger cities here in the United States. I mean, look at cities like Chicago,
yeah,
and Detroit,
yeah,
and there's a lot of smaller municipalities that are basically teetering on the precipice.
Yeah, or the state of Illinois.
So I think that's really, I think it's a sign of what's going to kind of hit the country in waves at some point.
Yeah. And you might be able to manage your way through a smaller thing like Puerto Rico, but something like the state of Illinois or the city of Chicago, like you said, might be a little bigger problem.
Right. And again, these numbers are off the top of my head. I think the Puerto Rico issue was like a $70 billion issue or something. I forget what the numbers are there. I mean, you know, you're looking at, you know, the state of Illinois has a pension fund that's hundreds of billions of dollars underfunded. And that's an area that's going to really take people by surprise. I have a good friend who works at a pension fund here in Denver. So I've gotten even more insight about how these pension funds operate and how they mark their books. And so when you see articles out there by these academics that say, oh, well, pension funds are, you know, collectively they're underfunded by $2 or $3 trillion, it's actually more than that. It's a lot more than that, because a lot of their holdings are not even remotely marked accurately. And at some point, they're going to be forced to have to mark those accurately. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Federal Reserve is going out of its way to keep the stock market from collapsing.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
if the stock market were to go down, you know, 20%, 30%, a lot of these pension funds would just be completely wiped out.
Well, shit, the high yield market. You know, how many of those things have pension funds been grasping for any kind of return by buying some, you know, dog shit high yield bond out of the, you know, the oil patch in North Dakota, you know?
Well, and what's interesting about that, like my friend was telling me, the inclination of the people that are running these funds is not to say, geez, let's figure out a way to extricate ourselves from this and move on. A lot of them are doubling down.
Yeah.
I mean, it's insane. And you got the high yield thing, but one of the things that people aren't even talking about is the allocation that these pension funds have to private equity.
Yeah.
And as the, you know, we're already starting to see the Silicon Valley phenomenon start to, you know, it's had its Roman candle moment and it's starting to crash back to earth. And those private equity they don't get marked to market every month. They maybe get marked to market quarterly. But, you know, at some point, some of these pension funds have as much as 20% allocated to private equity. And to me, that's a frightening thing, because it's an unproven asset class. It became extraordinarily, it basically became the privatized version of the internet bubble.
Yeah.
So think about what happened when the internet bubble crashed. Yeah. I mean, that's what's going to happen to the private equity side.
And no liquidity.
Right, exactly. Absolutely no liquidity.
Yes.
I mean, it became a big Ponzi scheme. The valuations of these private companies were predicated on their next round of financing. And every time they would get refinanced or financed, they'd get valued at a higher valuation. You know, and it was really a modern day Dutch tulip bulbs phenomenon.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. All right. Moving on, Mike had a follow up question asking about a column of yours that you just posted that even I haven't read yet, called More Fed.
What? I know. You don't go to my blog first thing in the morning when you wake up?
It's been a busy day, Dave. Anyway, he said this is called More Fed Protection, and he just wanted you to expand upon the thesis of what you wrote there.
Okay, this is something I'm actually surprised didn't get as much press as I thought it would. I think a couple alternative websites might have picked it up. I don't even know that Zero Hedge had the article, and it actually came out late last week, And I just didn't have time to write about it. And then I got to the point where, well, it's going to show up on Zero Hedge, so why bother? And so last night I just sat down and wrote about it. And what's happened here is that the Fed has installed a regulation in which the two big to fail banks, if one of them starts to fail, they can hold on to the collateral that's been deposited with them by their derivatives counterparties. So if hedge fund X enters into a derivatives trade with JP Morgan, okay, it has to put up collateral, so usually treasury. So it gives collateral. It's like a margin account. It's a big boy margin account. Okay. So they give JP Morgan treasury collateral. If JP Morgan starts to fail, the big hedge fund X is going to say, okay, I want my treasuries back. Because the big hedge fund is the rightful owner of those treasuries.
Right.
They can do that if their derivatives position is in a winning position, right? They don't have a capital call or anything. Well, the Fed has said no. The bank can hold on to that collateral because we need, you know, we want to have the ability to unwind these banks in an orderly fashion. That collateral is going to disappear down the rabbit hole.
It's
what happened in MF Global.
Exactly what I was just going to say.
Right. And so they're implementing, and the article made it sound like it was a proposal. Well, no, the ISDA contracts are now out there where it says, okay, the banks have at least a 48-hour stay on this collateral, and you know, 48-hour stay just means they have enough time to go before a judge and say, hey, we need a permanent stay on this collateral so that we can unwind this bank. We're going to have another Lehman problem.
Oh, God.
And as I pointed out in my article, Lehman wasn't really – that wasn't what caused the problem. It was a whole host of things. And it really ultimately – I tie it to the AIG Goldman situation.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But now here's the other thing, and this is where it really is frightening. The Fed can't make the rule retroactive. So if you have a derivatives – an ISDA contract, derivatives contract with JP Morgan prior to this new rule being put in place – you don't have to abide by it. You can say, okay, I'm not going to agree to this. But guess what? The new rule says if you don't agree to make this rule retroactive to all of your contracts, you can no longer do business with this bank.
Oh, my gosh.
Right.
And we're talking – JP Morgan's derivative book is what, $56 trillion or something? Now, obviously there's not $56 trillion worth of collateral, but there's a couple.
Well – as far as we know, it's $56 trillion. That's what they're reporting. Do you believe what they report?
Dave, first of all, for everybody listening, Dave, I'll grab that post and I'm going to make it into a guest post and put it up on the site right below this when we post it this afternoon, so that people make sure they read it because that's pretty important information. Can you follow that up? What makes me think about is the other thing you wrote about a couple weeks ago about the new where the CME opening an account at the Fed. You want to elaborate on what happened there?
Oh, right. Okay. Just real quickly on that, on the collateral situation. And again, I had to read through the Bloomberg article a few times to really figure out what was going on. The directive to do that, that the regulation the Fed's putting in came from the Financial Standards Board, the FSB, and that's an arm of the BIS. So this is actually a directive that was handed down to the central banks from the BIS. And it was born at around the same time that the bail-in directives were issued by the BIS, because that's where it's all coming from ultimately.
Right.
And this is really, you know, whereas the bail-ins are basically, you know, applied towards bank depositors. Okay, you got money in a bank, you're now a creditor to the bank if they go under. This is what I would call a big boy bail-in. So this is a bail-in. This is a bail-in of the banks that is going to be funded by hedge funds, pension funds, and insurance companies. But guess what? If you pierce through that veil, who are the ultimate investors in hedge funds, pension funds, and insurance companies? The little guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's just, again, this is just a way to, it's just transferring more wealth from the little guy to the banks as they collapse.
And that again, that story about the CME putting their bank's collateral into the Fed system. Expand on that again.
Well, I think that's kind of a similar thing.
Yeah.
you know, like the banks that trade on the COMEX or that are the market clearing banks, you know, the JP Morgans and HSBCs of the world, well, they when they go short, when they short contracts, they have to put collateral up for that. They got to collateralize it. They just can't, you know, sell a contract and not have any kind of collateral backing it. Well, what the Fed did, or what the CME did, is they said, hey, we want a central account at the Fed for that collateral. And to me, what I think, you know, if you look beneath the surface of what that means, is it gives the CME control over the collateral that JP Morgan, HSBC, Goldman Sachs, etc. put up against their market making positions. Mm-hmm. And it gives the CME more control over it. So that if JP Morgan goes tits up, JP Morgan can't grab that collateral and try and sell it and use that money. The CME has control of that collateral.
Which we would sure think that means maybe the CME is a little worried about that.
That's exactly what I think it means. I think the CME is looking at especially the COMEX specifically, looking at those positions and saying there's a problem coming.
Yeah.
And, you know, we need to protect ourselves.
Yep. All right, next question from Vernon. He just wonders if you could explain how bail-ins, and we talk about that at the big bank level. We were just talking about that. But how might that affect smaller banks and even credit unions? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Sure. This particular directive that was put in was specifically aimed at the too big to fail banks and their institutional counterparties, the hedge funds, insurance companies, and pension funds. And it doesn't per se apply to credit unions and smaller banks because you know they're not typically, you know, out there underwriting derivatives.
Right.
But having said that, I mean, you know, especially credit unions. I know credit unions are way over their skis in terms of making risky loans, primarily commercial real estate and auto loans. And I think at some point, you know, both of those asset classes, commercial real estate and auto loans, are going to implode. I think the auto loans are already starting to implode.
Yep.
And I think a lot of these credit unions are going to go into insolvency, in which case, if you've got money at a credit union, guess what? You're now a creditor, and they're going to use your money to bail in the credit union. So the bail-in concept applies from top to bottom, from the biggest banks, JP Morgan, Citibank, et cetera, all the way down to a small local credit union who's probably sitting on, you know, very risky, what I call nuclear assets, and the people who have money in those banks don't even realize it.
Right, right. Dave, you've been very generous with your time, and this is just extraordinarily informative, as I knew it would be. I've got 3 or 4 questions left. I might want to I'll try to go through them as quickly as I can for you.
Sure, no problem.
From Michael, who just wants to know what you think of the gold-silver ratio. How important of an indicator do you think it is, given where it is versus where it has been historically?
Oh, I think it's an all-important indicator. I was just trying to recalculate it as of today.
70,
72, 3. Yeah, exactly. And I think it might have peaked out in the mid 80s or high 80s.
Yeah, it got up over 80.
And actually in 2008, when they hit the precious metals ahead of the great financial collapse, well, they call it a crisis, but it was a collapse. I think it got as high as 100.
Yeah.
And during that, and then during the run up into 2011, it got as low as 30, you know, low 30s, just uh-huh. say, for sake uh-huh. of argument. So I think that the gradual decline of the gold silver ratio is one of the indicators that, you know, this the bull market is resuming. And I guess in my mind, I've always thought eventually the gold silver ratio would get down at least to its long-term historical mean, which is around 16.
Yeah.
And I think it probably will overshoot that. I mean, you know, if you go back to Roman times, the ratio was 8, and that was based on the amount of gold they were pulling out of the ground as a ratio of the amount of silver. So they're pulling out 8 ounces of of silver for every ounce of gold, and that's about what they're pulling out now. I think the ratio actually is about 9-1. So I think it's an important indicator to watch, and I think as it trends lower, that's just further confirmation that our market's going to go a lot higher.
Yep. All right, next question from Greg. Just wants to know what you think of the idea. Guys like Jim Willie have been talking about this for years, about a devalued dollar. Like, once the dollar global reserve currency standard falls apart, that maybe there'd be an international facing dollar, a domestic dollar. Anyway, great question basically is, what do you think of that idea?
That's a great question. And again, I mean, that's like kind of an issue I've thought about for almost as long as I've been involved in this sector, which is, about 15 years now. And so you're basically talking about a two-tiered currency, kind of one, a dollar that's used outside the U.S. and a dollar that's used inside the U.S. And if it, again, there's just no way to know how this whole situation is going to ultimately unfold. But if we get to a situation like that, we'll also be living under a system of pretty much totalitarianism.
Yeah.
Because that's a system that's designed for the government just to give the government complete control over the population.
Yeah.
And that's probably, it may not look like that. That's probably where we're headed in terms of, this cashless banking system where it's all done electronically, because that's essentially the same thing. It gives the government, they can monitor and have better control over what you're doing with your dollars.
With the attendant price inflation that would come with it, and with millions of people, middle-income people that are already stretched as soon as they can go, you almost have to have an authoritarian system that go with it.
That's right. And so I guess the short answer is we're going to see something like that. It's just going to probably be in a different form than what it's taken historically, because technology allows them to do that now.
All right, here's a question for you. I don't know how specific you'd want to get. I was actually at a concert with my brother-in-law back Friday night, watching The Who, which, by the way, Pete Townsend is 71 years old in a couple of weeks.
Was that good?
Oh, it's awesome. They played too many songs that I didn't know, but man, just to get up, and they start playing Bob O'Reilly or Won't Get Fooled Again, that kind of stuff, man. It was fun. Anyway, I digress. I looked at my brother-in-law. I was telling him I got cashed out. I had the opportunity to cash out of an old defined benefit plan from an insurance company I worked for a number of years. And they got a letter out of the blue in November, said, hey, get back to us in a couple of weeks, we'll cash you out at a present value. I said, yeah, okay. So they sent me a check, and I'd been watching the miners go sideways at 105, and I thought, screw it, I'm just going to start buying miners. And I'm up 70-80%, something like that. Maybe it's not that, but about 65, I guess, now. But anyway, I was talking to my brother-in-law, and he said, you ought to just dump all those things and get yourself a precious metal IRA. Why even continue to jack with it? And that's a question that Mark has. He says he's up 150% from the bottom. His plan is to eventually sell and move into precious metals, sell his mining shares. At what point do I sell the mining share rally and move into physical? And I guess maybe I'll add on, or is that just a gradual process for the prudent man?
That's a great question, and I get that question quite a bit. And I mean, there's no right answer to that. I mean, but if you look at a long-term chart, there's you can find them on the internet. There's graphs. People have put up these graphs that show the valuation of the juniors in relationship to the price of gold, and the one that I saw recently went back to like the mid-90s, I think. And when you look at that graph, you can see just how cheap the juniors are on a historical basis. I mean, I think relative to the price of gold and silver, the juniors became as cheap as they've ever been in history, like in December, I think is kind of when the whole thing really bottomed out, or early January. And so let's just say for sake of numbers, if you say, okay, the index got down to 100 and now it's at 200. Well, back in 2011, when it peaked out, the index was, say, at
600.
1,500. Well, no, more than that. 1,500. I mean, these things have. If we do get back to those valuations, and I think there's a good argument to be made that, you know, they're gonna. Let's put it this way: when I first got into this sector, Jim Dines had been writing about the mining stocks for a few years, and I, you know, I got into it in the early stages of when he was writing about it, and he was making the analogy that eventually these mining stocks are going to morph into what the internet bubble became. And it's taken a lot longer than I think any of us thought that that would happen because of the massive intervention that we've had to endure. But at some point, that's what's going to happen to this sector. So let's say if that index, that junior index that went from 100 to 200, you know, that thing could go to 2,000, you know, and it still probably wouldn't resemble how out of control the internet sector bubble had gotten.
No, that's right.
So, and I think that's what you want to wait around for. Now, having said that, I do think it's a good idea for some of these stocks that have that I think a lot of them have gotten ahead of themselves. So, you know, if you've got a stock that's gone up 500%, it could go sideways for a while, you know, before it takes another leg up. Take some money off the table and move it into physical gold and silver. I'd buy silver right now because I think silver is, again, it's historic. I think it's historically one of the cheapest asset classes out there. You know, so take some profits, but don't take everything off the table. I think you got to leave a lot of money on the table in these juniors, and it's going to be bumpy. I mean, it's a volatile sector.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what's been interesting about what I think's, you know, happened over the last few months. It's like the hits have been somewhat shallow because I think there's a lot of money on the sidelines waiting for that next big hit to move in. You know, and as long as that money's there waiting to move in, they may not get a chance, and at some point they're going to have to start chasing this.
Yeah. You know, so, I referenced an interview I did a couple hours ago. I referenced, remember that video that Grant Williams put out in January about nobody cares, I think is what he called it. Do you remember seeing that?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Wasn't it in that video where he talked about the, I mean, it would take like $2 billion. Now, this was in January, so it's probably twice as much now. But it would take a couple billion dollars, and you could buy the 20 largest producers. You could just buy them all. Just buy every share. I mean, it was nothing. And if the institutions start to catch wind of this, yeah, we're up 100%, but talk about the tip of the iceberg.
Well, here's the statistic. And Craig, you've been around this market as long as I have been, and the people used to write about this all the time, you know, say from 2001 to 2005, 2006, and then it kind of got disappeared. It kind of disappeared, the concept. But, you know, the market cap of the top 10 stocks in the S&P 500 individually is greater than the market cap of the mining stocks globally, talk just gold and silver. I'm not talking about, like, you know, the Rio Tintos of the world. But if you took gold and silver, precious metals, mining stocks globally and added the market cap together, that combined market cap in the top 10 stocks in the S&P 500 individually. Now think about that. And it got even more extreme than that in this in the last leg down.
Right.
You know, where it probably stretched out to, you know, maybe the top 50 or 100 stocks in the S&P 500 each individually had a bigger market cap than the gold and silver mining stocks collectively.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and that kind of is just another way of saying what Grant Williams was saying is, hey, it's not going to take a very large percentage of institutional money to start moving into this sector to really light it on fire.
Exactly. And you certainly can't say that that's happened yet.
And the other thing that people are thinking about is you're looking at the valuations of these stocks with gold and silver where it is. Well, I mean, you know, I could easily see gold doubling or tripling over the next 18 to 24 months here. And if that happens, silver is going to go up 300, 400, 500%.
Yeah.
And with most of these companies, they've become so lean in terms of their cost structure over the last 5 years. They had to do that to survive. So that, it, you know, if their cost of getting gold out of the ground or silver out of this, gold out of the ground, let's say it was $1,500 an ounce. Well, now it's $1,000 an ounce or $800 an ounce. There's some gold companies that you know, their cost of getting it out of the ground now is $700 or $800.
Right. I spoke with Keith Neumeyer a couple weeks ago, and I asked him, and this is just specific to First Majestic, but I said, I mean, you mine 20 million ounces a year. Every dollar that an ounce of silver goes up, how much of that flows through to your bottom line? He said it's about 90%.
Right. That's the point I was getting to, is right. That we're at the point now where, and it's a lot more powerful of an effect now than it was in the first time around when we ran up into 2011. Because the cost structure of these companies is so much lower now, especially with the price of energy. I mean, the energy is 50% of the cost of mining gold and silver.
Yep.
So, you know, if gold goes from $1,300 to $1,500, you got almost $200 an ounce of gold that's mined that falls right to the bottom line.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Dave, we're almost an hour into this, so I've got one last question for you, and then we better begin to wrap up. Gosh, thank you so much for your time this morning. This last question comes from Gabe, who I'll just read what he wrote. He said, with the U.S. Treasury Department's recent publication of a set of, quote, monitoring tools, unquote, aimed at currency manipulation by China, Germany, Japan, and others, has traditional cooperation and collusion among central banks begin to break down and our currency wars really beginning to heat up?
I think that's exactly what's going on. And what I found was interesting about that is the U.S. is lashing out at all these countries as being currency manipulators. The U.S. is the biggest manipulator in the world. There's no bigger market manipulator than the U.S.
Exactly.
I mean, the duplicity and hypocrisy of this country just knows no bounds.
Across all everywhere. You know, whether.
But yes, that's actually just, you know, that's a really good point, because I made that comment to a friend of mine a couple weeks ago. I said, you know, I think the elitists are starting to turn on each other. This could get really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, my friend, let me begin. Oh, hold on. Somebody just typed me something. We're here. A little commercial for you. Ted wants to know, what does it take to get into your hedge fund that you run? Do you have to be an accredited investor, you know, with $1 million net worth and stuff like that? Or how does it work?
It's an accredited investor fund. And we have an investment minimum. I have a partner that's kind of in charge of all that. So if he wants me to put him in touch with my partner can go over everything with him. Just have him email me, and I'd be happy to help him out.
Fair enough. All right. If you're ready, then, my friend, it's time to wrap up with the final four. I know it's your favorite part of the show.
And the whole show's my favorite part of the show, Craig. I love this show.
You're too kind. All right, but the final four, remember, these are four that you can just usually answer pretty quickly, maybe a word, sentence, something like that. And we're going to go with a Colorado theme today, if you will.
I know what's coming.
You are Denver Dave. You know, most everybody knows Billy Joel, right?
Yep.
And Billy Joel, remember, was in Los Angeles when he wrote Piano Man, getting out of New York for a while. And when he wrote Piano Man and all those kind of things, he was thinking about his home state of New York, and he wrote New York State of Mind shortly thereafter. And there's a line in New York State of Mind that says he's been high in the Rockies under the evergreens. So, Dave, have you ever been high in the Rockies under the evergreens?
Well, you know, I got to wait until pot's been legal for 7 years, so the statute of limitations runs out.
We'll leave it at that. Fair enough, we can leave it at that.
When I climb a 14er, I get a natural high.
All right, next question. What is a better mascot, Ralphie the Buffalo or Bernie the St. Bernard, the mascot of the Avalanche?
Oh, Ralphie's the best mascot ever. I will say, when you, like, if you go backcountry skiing, you hike up to about 13,000 feet, you know, and there's usually people up there passing a joint around, and, you know, you'd be unsocial not to, you know, if you turned it down. That's what I really call high in the Rockies, when you're way above tree line and you take a hit of that. I'm too old to do that now, but, you know, that's from my younger days.
Unfortunately, you got to ski all the way down to find the donuts and the Doritos.
It makes the skiing a lot more interesting. Let's put it that way.
No doubt about that. All right, question number three. Do you own a pair of Birkenstocks?
Can I take the fifth there?
Yes.
I actually don't have the sandal Birkenstocks. I've got a pair of Birkenstocks that's like a suede clog, and they're probably the most comfortable shoe I've ever worn.
And you live in Colorado, and I think
that doesn't mean I have liberal politics.
Gotcha. All right. And, along those lines, when was the last time you ate granola?
Hey, granola is a staple food for every good Coloradan.
While you're wearing your Birkenstocks, actually.
I've got granola in my cabinet. I don't eat it every day, but it's there if I get hungry for it. I get the munchies.
No, well, there you go. All right, my friend. Again, one more time, tell everybody where they can find your work on the interwebs.
Okay, my website is investmentresearchdynamics.com, and everything sort of flows from there. And Craig, I really appreciate you having me on the show. This is, of all the shows I do, this is probably the most fun one to do. It's so laid back and casual, and your listener, your audience asks great questions.
They sure.
And I will take a look at Bear Creek. It might not happen today, but I'll email you back with what my opinion is of on it, and feel free to share it with your subscribers and your audience.
That's fun. I'll tuck it in the comments of this podcast when we get it posted. Dave, thank you so much, man. I tell you what, it's always fun to visit with you, and you just are able to keep track of so much more stuff than I am, and the information you share and the stuff you write about helps to everybody in the community. So thank you so much, and wish you a great rest of your day, and hopefully we'll do this again soon.
Thanks, Craig. I'd love to. Anytime.
And everybody else, we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.